Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show which brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to the channel, please subscribe so you won't miss a new episode. I'm your host, Fritz Bussemaker, and today I'm delighted and privileged to have a conversation with David Evans. Evan, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Fritz. Happy to be here.
Let me introduce David. Who's David? He's a senior advisor with UNICEF. He's a public-private, where he looks at public-private partnerships. He used to be the chief of global philanthropy, not only there, but also at UBS. He used to be the head private sector at the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Now, you lived in Beijing, China, Singapore, Geneva, New York, London. And as you lived everywhere, your education is just as international, INSEAD in France, Colombo in the US, Oxford in the UK. Now, that's a very long and strong track record. To add just a couple of things to that, you also have a couple of honors. So you've been recognized as a filmmaker, even at the BAFTAs you won an award. And for those who don't know, that's the UK version of winning an Oscar. And a certified yoga instructor and Chinese language proficiency. That's a lot. Now, this is going to be a great talk. I know this, David, just by that introduction. Now, as I just mentioned, if I look at your background, a lot what I read is about philanthropy, getting people behind common goals. But that's not how you started off your career. You started something completely different. Could you expand a little bit on that?
Yes, Fritz. As you said, I started out as a filmmaker, came to the US to go to film school here, did a course, and then they said, "Oh, by the way, in order to graduate, you have to make a film," and I had no resources whatsoever, and really quite struggling in New York, and I had to put together an hour-long film, which in those days was quite a significant undertaking. It's different now in the world of video and everything. And what I the process when you're making a film or a TV program or anything is about creating a vision and getting others to share that vision and getting others also to coordinate amongst themselves, contribute, coordinate, and move towards that vision. And along the way, there's bumps in the road, there's setbacks, there's successes, there's shared experiences and learning together and growth together. And it's a wonderful experience. And we have this in so many ways, whether it's a birthday party we're organizing for our child or with friends, or whether it's a film that we're making. And really, that kind of process of defining and articulating a future state, where you want to get to, what you can see, this thing that you can see, this story you want to tell and unfold, is really the thing that I've taken forward into my continuing professional career and personal life.
Okay.
So I was in New York. I was making films, I was making documentaries. I was going okay. I was on TV, getting a few awards and stuff. And slowly I found that there was a decline in kind of meaning. There was a decline in this feeling significant to me. And this was about the time of the sort of internet.com boom, the first of many, say about 2000.
Yeah.
And it suddenly seemed to be working and struggling, putting together films to talk about social issues and social change was not really the most meaningful way to use your time. That there were other people who were using different ways to imagine a future, painting different pictures of the future, and then using IT business to achieve those goals. And really, I it suddenly that seemed to be something that I really, really wanted to do. So I went off to.
Is that something which you gradually become aware, or do you suddenly wake up, hey, I need to change something?
I think I gradually became aware of this, and you know, in order to be the sort of pure artist that I imagined myself to be, I had to learn to deal with the world. So I had to learn about fundraising. I had to learn about team management. I had to learn. I also had to make a lot of trade-offs. Right. I was doing a lot of very commercial TV work in order to subsidize, enable me to do the more creative, socially driven mm-hmm. Film projects. And so I was changing, and I was becoming at this point of exchange where I was doing all these things and in order to kind of achieve this vision that I was still going. And what I slowly realized, well, look, all the skills and the capabilities that you're building up can be applied. You know, you're very much focused in a very narrow thing, but all these skills and capabilities and the ability to lead, inspire, motivate others can be used in a host of different ways. And that's really what one of the key drivers is. When you get into a situation where you're able to change people or change the way they think about themselves, that's really, really, really exciting, because that goes on into their life and they start to influence others. And I guess, you know, with filmmaking at that time, you know, it was like, where is my audience? And that looking for doing different kinds of work enabled me to find new audiences, but still take this idea of, okay, we're making a movie here. We're going to create a new vision of how things can be or should be. And I'll give you a very good example of that, which is one of the things I'm most proud of, actually, which is, so shortly after business school, I did a few things for a year working on public-private partnerships. I don't know why. This is always something that has come back to me, which is, how do you knit together the world of philanthropy, government, and the private sector? And it's come back to me again and again in different forms, first in China, then in India. And then I found myself working in this agency. I was just hired as a consultant. I'd never really thought about this issue before, but it was AIDS, TB, and malaria. And at that time, the world had this terrible conundrum, because HIV drugs had become available. They were cripplingly expensive, and there were people dying. And actually, one of the last films I made was in New York, was a man who had a garden who had AIDS contacted me. And he'd created this garden on the street with his lover who died of AIDS. And he was dying of AIDS, and he wanted someone to memorialize his garden. It was called Norman Valley. And down on 8th Street. So I did this film, and somehow this actually became very, very meaningful in my life. The film, you know, normally somehow I didn't move on to that project, and I actually ended up working this huge AIDS funding organization. And they had been really the challenge of getting people to support and address this critical challenge, because it was so expensive, and it's a lifelong commitment. And once you put somebody on HIV AIDS treatment, that's a lifelong commitment. You've got to be able to say, well, where they're going to get their drugs from next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. With working with an inspirational colleague who hired me, we said, you know, I think we said, let's just change the frame of reference here, because we were going around, they I think they got like $1 million, which is seemed a lot of money at the time, still a little money to me personally, but they got a little money from the private sector, but not really. They said, why don't we change the paradigm? Why don't we change this? And why don't we get private go to private sector, because it's not working now, and why don't we go and give them the real deal and ask them for a cripplingly large amount of money and say, this is what it's going to make a difference to these communities who are dying right now. And, you know, there's like 20-30% people with HIV positive in places like South Africa at the time. So we did that, and we somehow believed in it. We had this future state, and it worked. I mean, that was the amazing thing. It worked because it was so transformational that we got the meetings that we wanted to meet. We met the companies. So we took an organization that had received $1 million and, for example, with one big company, they gave us $30 million, and then it became $55 million. And this was purely by coming back to this thing of just saying, let's imagine what the future state, let's not do pie in the sky, but let's just imagine where we need to be and what are the pieces what are the pieces of the puzzle that we have to fit together? Who do we have to talk to? And what is fit for purpose in the place we want to be? And then you get this amazing experience of reinforcing success, other things getting unlocked. The organization now, they have private sector, like there's one initiative we were involved in starting, which is like $400-500 million. And I often imagined when I was working, I was still like had this filmmaker mentality, and I sort of did a calculation. Okay, lifetime treatment for people on AIDS. How many people would $30 or $50 million? How many? You know, in that time it was sort of like a large town. Mm-hmm. And actually, in my mind, I imagined this town somewhere. It was in South Africa, actually. It didn't have to be, but I imagined this town, and I imagined the shops and the people and the buildings and the life, and I imagined this whole community of people who, through our fundraising, it was all about the money, but through our activities, we were actually creating this community of people who would have access to life, who would live. And I think it was a great lesson for me. And actually, my boss at the time was called Rajesh Anandan, mm-hmm. who's, you know, he just said, well, look, you might as well, you've got to go for the thing that works. And you've got to go for the thing that actually is going to meet the needs that you're doing. Otherwise, there's no point.
David, a couple of questions I have in the story for you, because, I mean, this is an amazing story. You're already talking about your shift from being a filmmaker to working to help battle AIDS and other illnesses. What I'm hearing is sometimes it helps to have that big, hairy, audacious goal. Because if your ambition is 1 million, it's going to be 1 million. But if you then turn that around and look what you really need, the goal changes. But by setting that goal as this is what you should be achieved, it becomes realistic all of a sudden.
Yeah. And also, you know, getting $1 million is pretty hard work. Yeah. This is what Rajesh used to say to me. That's pretty hard work. So you might as well go for what is going to be meaningful. And, you see all sorts of organizations, philanthropy, struggling, you know, it's this huge world of struggle and people not having resources, underachievement. And that was an important do a few things right, but do them as big and impactful.
One question before we move on to philanthropy. So when you moved from your film, I'd say, community to this new community, how many people in the film community said to you, David, so don't do this, you're throwing away your career. I mean, look at all your achievements so far. That's where you should be. I mean,
No, they said, it was exactly the opposite. I mean, it's a bit of a joke, I tell you this, but they all said, look, you know, quite often with some of your I mean, this is the other thing that I found, which was they said, yeah, you know, you're okay as a filmmaker. You're not Federico Fellini. You're not going to be in the, you know, you're okay. You're good. But you're really good in terms of putting together these projects and actually getting people to do these things. That's what you're amazing at. And they said to me, you know, I mean, literally, they would say, I cannot believe that you got money to make that film, David. Or how were you able to, you know, so the message, this was actually another driver for me, because the reflection I was getting back was, how is that possible for you to get funding for or getting access to this place or getting this person to cooperate? And this was the thing I had the kind of real gift for. So it was actually a lot of encouragement from those people who kind of get it, because you know, they know the challenge of trying to bring something out of nothing, which is any film is like that. Any film, any TV production is like that.
But may I also assume that when you produce a film, this is about storytelling. How important is, you could say, the experience of storytelling in your current work?
Really important. You know, and it's also, I would say, there's many stories going on, particularly when you're working with partners, and you really, the thing that you have to do is understand the story that people, that you're, particularly with philanthropists, you know, what is the story that is unfolding here, and where do I, you know, and people tend to have this very blinkered view and think about what I've got to achieve. But you have to look at, particularly working in philanthropy, you have to really look at the other people as an actor, and what is the story unfolding here. It's a little bit off the record, but you know, what is the biggest kind of story in the world of philanthropy right now is, it's the whole story of the Gates Foundation.
Yeah.
And what an amazing story that the, you know, Bill Gates, you can probably remember in the old days, he was seen as, well, you know, this almost hate figure of hate because of the dominance of Microsoft. And he was seen as this sort of unfeeling person. And the sea change that he and his ex-wife achieved with the establishment of the foundation, addressing health issues, bringing some of the skills and know-hows and the ways of working that he'd adopted at Microsoft into the foundation is really, really interesting. And now, right now in 2022, we can see there's also another story unfolding, which is, it's a huge institutional foundation. It's a large institutional force in the world of philanthropy. But there's also this question underneath still of the unfolding personal stories of Bill Gates and Melinda Gates. And of course, they have now gone their separate ways. They've divorced. And that is a very, very important part of this story. So when you're engaging with any philanthropist, you need to understand the human dynamics and what's going on underneath, as well as all the technical stuff about impact and social impact and metrics and risk analysis and all this kind of thing. And people get lost in the technicalities very, very often.
Okay, because Once you were head of the Global Fund of Fight Age, then you moved to, I believe, to UBS, head of philanthropy. Did they approach you, or did you volunteer?
They approached me, and you know what was interesting about working in the financial sector is that, you know, very, very smart people, but I mean, you know, they really have this thing about going with what works. And all banking does have, I was really, really surprised actually, because I found that they really, really zoomed in on this personal human dimension.
Okay.
So for example, you know, philanthropy is about human legacy. It's about your position in society now, but it's also about the legacy you want to leave, the way you want to be remembered. It's also the way your family and your children, the lives that they will take up, and the meaning that they will bring to their lives. It's a very, very personal thing. And it was wonderful for banking institutions, because it gets you right into the heart of the client and their deepest needs. And you can maybe help them in that really journey for meaning that they're looking for themselves. And UBS, and I mean, they are ruthlessly, you know, they're financial institutions. They're not socially mission driven institutions. But it was very, very interesting to see that they had that perspective. And when they were thinking about a client, they would think about the business, the family. They would think about the philanthropy, all as one thing, about how they would try to bring together a holistic offering for their client. So I think when you're dealing in any encounter or dealing with, you know, it's, and it comes back to some of the things I learned as a filmmaker, you know, you know the performance, you know the story you want to tell when you're engaging with somebody, and you have to think about how this ties together with everything else that's going on in their life, their business, whatever's happening. So I think in terms of operating in the social sector and trying to be effective, I think listening is really, really, really important. And listening as much as kind of, you know, people talk about pitching, or they talk about all these, you know, this transmission of a message and how you transmit a message. And I'm sure those things are very, very important. And they think about share a voice and who can shout loudest and who can get their message out there. But really, the really, really important thing is to listen and understand the objectives and needs, unspoken needs, doubts, you know, of the people, the person that you're dealing with, if you want to persuade them, and the things that they're not saying to you about their hesitations and their experience to date. And this is, I would say, if you're looking to work in this area, or you're looking to drive change, move people, and shape the future, you know, there's room for introverts in this world, I would say. I mean, we tend to have this idea of a heroic extrovert, you know, the social enterprise founder, the blah, 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 blah. And those people are wonderful because they have that vision thing. But the other part of it is also, you need other people to come with you. And in order to do that, you need to receive, as well as just kind of put out the thing that you want to get done. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's a bit.
No, at least I understand that. Now, you have worked for about the past 20 years with the leading philanthropists around the world. Are these people for you role models, or do you seek your inspiration and role models elsewhere?
That's a very good question. I mean, there are wonderful, you know, I think there are wonderful examples of people, and there just are inspiring examples. I say, I, I, I met a man with UBS, and he was going to give it all away.
Yeah.
He didn't want any of it. He had about $400 million, and his aim was to have nothing. And he had a religious commitment to that. And I found that really, really inspiring. Yes, I mean, I think they are. I think, you know, there are wonderful people who are making a choice. They have a choice with their resources and assets. They can just continue to accumulate. They can and they opt to actually work in this business and look to drive change. And, you know, I think Bill Gates is a wonderful example. He's really worked hard at it. I mean, there's all kinds of issues, but I really respect and admire him for doing that. My personal role models are much more, more philosophical. And this whole question about, and actually that's what was my major at university, which was about thinking about what is the highest good and what is the way to think about the nature of good and evil and
it's a nice segue to a question we ask people on this program. That is, what does success mean for you? What is success for you?
Honestly, it's I'm very, I think one of the things people note about me is I'm very, very, it's just the next project. It's the next film. It's the next project and getting that off the ground. I'm very much about, keeping whatever idea is driving me and motivating me towards that achievement of that goal. I've never for a second really thought of myself as a role model until today. So that's great. What I also do, and now as I'm, you know, in my 50s, is I really, really love it when people say, you know, you've helped me, you've influenced me, you've changed the way I think about what I'm going to do in the future. And I really love that kind of mentoring and kind of setting people, empowering people to go and be to achieve their full potential, and that is a huge feeling of reward. And
could it be that the best role models are those people who not recognize they are a role model and just do what they're doing?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you do have to action some good behavior. I mean, what I do when I disagree with groupthink or consensus, I do make a point of always not being a pain about it, but mm-hmm. just articulating it very, very clearly. And I that is a sort of conscious role modeling, because I do think large institutions, yes. like where I work, they tend to fall into groupthink. And it's very, very important for people to understand, no, you don't have to just follow what everyone else says. You can just put forward your opinions. So I do try to actively model that if I can, and show people that's valued and respected. Unfortunately, where I work now, UNICEF is a place where that is actually kind of encouraged and tolerated. So that's great.
Okay. Good to hear that. Now, because in this last part of the interview, David, I also want to explore something a little bit more personal, which made me very curious when I heard about this, because you've been influenced quite a lot by China and Chinese culture. I mean, you took up Chinese cooking, the practice of Chinese calligraphy. You actually played the ancient Chinese zither, or how's it pronounced?
Guqin.
Guqin.
Yeah, I played the Guqin, a zither. Yeah, which is an amazing. It was Confucius's favorite musical instrument. It's about 3,000 years old. I think.
So how did that? Because that sounds like this is going overboard. getting everything.
It disappeared. Yeah, yeah, it became happenstance. If you remember, I was a filmmaker in New York, and I was doing all these commercial jobs to survive, and I got a job, which was to go to China just as it was really kind of opening up, and do TV commercials there. And really, I think it was such an eye-opening thing for me. Literally, the first day I arrived in China, we did this great press conference in the great Hall of the People, which is still there on Tiananmen Square. I think in my lifetime, there's two just mega stories which keep coming back. One is about the unfolding of technology and the way that is changing the nature of who we are and pushing us forward. The other one is this extraordinary civilizational shift that we've seen with China. So when I was first, I mean, people say everyone has their own China stories, but when I first went to China, you know, it was all Mao suits. It was, you know, and the challenge, I don't want to say oppositional challenge, but the way that China has lifted 600-700 million people out of poverty is something which should give us all in the kind of Western social democracies pause for thought. And it's something that we must engage with. There are certainly, we can see there are tensions, there are negative externalities, there are all kinds of issues. But this has been a huge story shaping shift, a seismic shift in the nature of the world's economy and society. So in my life, you know, of course, I've been dealing with Chinese philanthropists and talking with them about, you know, what they want to, and their attitudes are very, very, very different. They have different attitudes towards wealth. China has this idea that wealth cannot go past three generations. So there's very much this kind of accumulate, but also this wariness about loss of influence. So I've just got deeper and deeper and deeper into that over like 20 or 30 years. And it's been hugely, now, professionally, I have less to do with China, but personally, it's a huge part of my life. And I particularly have gone very deeply into Chinese philosophy, whether it's Confucian, Taoist, or Zen, Chinese Chan, Buddhist thinking. And coming back to this question, I do think, the ways of operating, there is a lot to interrogate some of the conflicts and some of the tensions that we see in our Western democracies. I do think we should interrogate these a little bit and look at models, not just China, but other ways where society seems to be less kind of constructed around this oppositional dynamic, which we seem to be spiral that we seem to be having in certainly places like US now in 2022. Okay. So for me, it's been a wonderful kind of journey.
And it's also a lesson to look beyond the surface and look a little bit closer to what's actually out there.
Well, yeah. And the other thing to say is, you know, in order to work with, you know, in order to engage with Chinese business and philanthropists, and you know, my approach is always to read heavily in history, the background, the philosophy, the culture, the food, gardening, the music, and then when you talk to somebody, you have some cultural insight, you have some point of connectivity, and that's hugely beneficial when you actually want to collaborate with somebody.
I understand that. Last, just a question before I ask my final question. Was this a coincidence that you dove into the Chinese culture? Could have been India, could it have been Africa, or was that already a given that it's going to be China?
I think it was in terms of my generation, as I said, I think this China moment and the transition in China was an extraordinary thing that happened. I think there's huge things to discover. Yeah. And I've had the pleasure of, through the UN, you know, worked in Africa, worked in the Gulf, and there's huge transitions going on there. I think, you know, as a young as a young person, I think you should see what are the changes happening right now that are making my world and remaking my world and making the future of the world now. And I think China was that in my generation, but and it's still very hugely dynamic and significant. But I think people should always look for where's the frontier now? Where is change happening right now? And it might be changes happening in your community about different forms of ownership or different ways of working. It might be where the frontier right now is on technology and how, you know, the social media and that. But see what the frontier is, which is shaping and defining your we all live in time. We don't just live in space, we live in time as well. And your generation and your the moment that you live in is very, very, is different for everybody. And see where that point of inflection is, and then go there and have a look and see what difference you can make there.
David, you've actually answered my last question without actually me having to ask you that. And that is, what would your advice be to young managers starting out on their journey? And I think you've just answered that question for me.
Great. Yeah, I would think that's, I also think the role of management moving to, you know, we're moving to in very flattening of the world, hierarchy, flattening, empowering others. These are really, really important changes. And you don't, as a young manager, you don't need to be the one who knows all the answers or knows everything. You need to be the person that is giving people, supporting people, and giving people space to achieve their own potential. And that's where you'd want to be as a manager now. And it's hugely rewarding.
David, great insights, connecting your personal background and story to an advice to the next generation. David, I want to thank you so much talking with the brand called You. Thank you.
Thanks, Ritz. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.